Support for WPR comes from the Stevens Point area, offering a variety of getaway experiences. Itineraries and ideas for beer lovers, foodies, outdoor recreation fans, and more are at StevensPointArea.com.
This is Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell, filling in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk to the author of the Diary of a Wimpy Kid books about the latest installment in the series.
But first, we're talking about three new drunk driving bills that passed in the state assembly today in Wisconsin. All three of these bills would toughen the penalties for those who drive drunk.
Frank Harris is with us, State Legislative Affairs Manager for Mothers Against Drunk Driving. Frank, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on the call.
So it sounds like the assembly moved pretty quickly today. Three pieces of legislation on drunk driving and three of them passed.
Yeah, that is correct. And Matt is very thankful for that, especially one measure was just introduced last week and it already passed the assembly. So that's a good sign of the movement in Wisconsin to reform the drunk driving law. And again, all three of these measures are very important in reforming the state's OWI law. Well, and we're very happy, but there's still, you know, more room for improvement.
Let's take the bills one at a time.
Sure.
One of them would require a first-time drunk driver to not only pay a fine, which they already mm-hmm. do, I believe, but appear in court as well. Why is that a step, as you see it, in the right direction?
Well, again, drunk driving is a choice, and that bill demonstrates that drunk driving is a serious offense, and it's worthy of more attention than just a simple traffic infraction. And, you know, Matt believes that anybody who makes the choice to drive drunk has at the very least earned the opportunity to appear in court to face the consequences of their reckless decision.
How does Wisconsin stack up against other states when it comes to criminalizing first-time drunk driving?
Well, you know, most states have some sort of criminal penalty for a first offense, at least an option on the book where an offender could be charged with a criminal misdemeanor. And actually in Wisconsin, they can charge first-time offenders who drive drunk with a child passenger in a vehicle with a criminal misdemeanor on the first offense. But all in all, Wisconsin is really one state that does not, at least on the book, criminalize all first offenses.
Another bill of the three would raise the penalty for repeat offenders, making the fourth offense, as I understand it, a felony. Why is that needed when we get to the fourth offense?
Well, again, by the time someone's a repeat offender, there's a lot going on and just a slap at a wrist. There needs to be treatment, there needs to be incarceration, there needs to be an all-of-the-above approach. And that bill really gives prosecutors more tools in handling these repeat drunk drivers who either have four convictions in their lifetime or at least two convictions. And this closes a loophole where some repeat drunk drivers are simply falling through the cracks.
All right. And then the third one involves ignition interlocks. Now, first of all, what are those and how does this change the laws on the books?
Well, first of all, ignition interlocks, since 2006, Matt has been, this has been our top legislative priority in every single state. And an ignition interlock is tied into a vehicle's ignition of a convicted drunk driver. And an offender who's ordered on one of these, at least in Wisconsin, has to blow into the device to prove their sobriety. And then some come with cameras to verify the identity of the user. And then there's also rolling retests where the offender has to, again, is prompted given time to, again, blow into the device. So you just can't have a friend at a bar blow into it. So they become sophisticated devices, and they're very effective compared to the traditional sanction of just hoping for the best with license suspension alone. In Wisconsin, ignition interlocks, as of 2010, are required for all the repeat, all offenders who refuse, and first-time offenders of a 0.15 BAC or greater. And what Assembly Bill 467 does is it essentially closes a loophole where if an offender who was ordered on one of these interlocks by a judge was driving a non-interlocked vehicle and was pulled over by law enforcement, all law enforcement could do is just give him a driving on a suspended license violation. As opposed to a more serious offense, such as driving without a court-ordered interlock. So that closes this loophole. And again, this is a very important bill because throughout the United States, Matt has been advocating tirelessly for more effective ignition interlock laws.
And that's been a criticism of laws so far. Won't they just drive somebody else's car? This tries to close that option.
Correct. And, well, this helps close that. And it's not a silver bullet, but it's more effective than which is a current approach for first offenders at a 0.08 to a 0.14 blood alcohol level, which is just an occupational license where it's geographically restricted or time restricted. How in the world is that even enforced? And we hope that the next step that the Assembly takes is introducing legislation that gives an option for a first offender to go on an interlock restricted license and where they can drive wherever they want to, as opposed to the current approach, which is just a hope for the best occupational type license, which is, quite frankly, just we're not sure how that's being enforced.
We've got a caller on the line. Lauren in Ripon wants to talk about this. Lauren, hi, you're on the air.
Hi there. My understanding with over policy is that it's not effective. And creating these laws and continuing to do so and making them stricter and greater punishments doesn't seem to be making a difference. If you look at some of the data from Utah, they have very hardcore laws that don't prove to be that effective. So,
all right. Thanks for the call, Lauren. So the people who are out drunk driving are maybe not thinking things through well enough to be deterred by these stricter punishments, Frank.
Well, you know, again, thanks, Lauren, for that phone call. And you know, that's why Matt has been pushing for more effective penalties. And you know, I'm from Wisconsin. I get told every time I come back there that, well, you know, you just enforce the laws that are on the books. Well, it's hard to enforce the laws on the books when there's conflicting loopholes throughout the statutes. And the bills that were authored by Representative Jim Ott that successfully passed the Assembly today closes those loopholes. And again, what's also key is enforcement of these laws. And that's why law enforcement should be given the option, you know, to continue with saturation patrols, and there should be an adult discussion on sobriety checkpoints. And enforcing these laws is critical as well.
And that's I wanted to talk about things that aren't in these laws today. Sobriety checkpoints is something you're looking for?
Well, that's going to be very difficult to advance in Wisconsin. But again, it's just educating on what exactly sobriety checkpoints are. And today we're really talking about, you know, these three bills, which are a very important improvement. But, you know, as it relates to other things that could help improve and make the law more effective in Wisconsin, it would be enforcing the current laws in the books. And one way to do that is effectively is through sobriety checkpoints. But it's going to be a difficult hill to climb. But what might be more possible is something that, such as the ignition interlock starting on the first offense at a 0.08, giving that option to a first offender to go on an interlock restricted license following an arrest as opposed to a occupational license. And if an offender's on an interlock license, they could drive wherever they want to, as opposed to the current law where they restricted to where they can drive, which is just unenforceable and unworkable.
One argument I've seen from some people is part of the solution to drunk driving in Wisconsin is to change our culture where it isn't just accepted as something we take for granted. Do you think stricter legal penalties, in addition to the penalties themselves, help change that culture?
Well, need to change laws in order to change culture. And I doubt it's the culture of Wisconsin that in 2011, 196 people were killed in drunk driving crashes caused by somebody who made the choice to drive drunk and risk their lives as well as their fellow citizens' lives. So, in order to change culture, you need to change laws. And one way to do this is with a more effective approach. And these three bills are a better way to change these laws and also just continue with the discussion that always plan ahead and designate a non-sober drinking driver when you're going out. Use the taxpayer-funded Safe Ride program if it's available in your county. There's no reason to drive drunk today in 2013.
And just briefly looking ahead, these passed the Assembly today. Are you optimistic they'll pass the Senate and cross the governor's desk?
Well, Matt's hopeful that it'll move forward, that these three bills, as well as I think there's another bill, Assembly Bill 180, will move forward in the Senate. Because, again, these are needed improvements that stakeholders and Representative Jim Ott and Senator Darling have worked very tirelessly on.
All right, Frank, thanks so much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
That's Frank Harris, State Legislative Affairs Manager for Mothers Against Drunk Driving. Now it's time for a look at the dreaded days of middle school mishaps with Jeff Kinney, author of the Diary of a Wimpy Kid series.
The series deals with dorky protagonist Greg Heffley, who can't seem to catch a break as he navigates the complexities of his early teens.
Jeff Kinney has been called a children's book rock star. He's sold tens of millions of copies of his books around the globe. To date, his books have been turned into three films as well. The eighth installment in his Wimpy Kid series is called Hard Luck, comes out today. Jeff, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So why have people gravitated so much to your lead character, Greg Heffley?
I think that kids see themselves in Greg. You know, when I read books as a kid and the central character was heroic, I felt like I was reading about miniature adults and not like kids like I was. So I wanted to create a character who was more like I was as a kid and less like the heroes in today's films and TV shows.
And that's what I make of Greg when I've read the books with my kids or watched the movies. Sometimes he's a bit of a jerk. Sometimes his troubles with friends are of his own making.
Right. I think that if any of our lives were documented while we were in middle school, we wouldn't come out looking too favorably. So I really wanted to kind of capture that kind of spirit for these books, is that Greg, he's not a bad guy. He's just a kid he's not fully formed yet. He's not a fully formed person yet. So he's a work in progress.
And that seems like something anybody in middle school, junior high could identify with, definitely.
Right.
Well, I hate to ask authors how much of you is in this character, but you kind of alluded to it, so I'll ask you, how much of you is in Greg?
I think that all the worst parts of me are in Greg, actually. So I think that, you know, he's the parts I'm not so proud of.
And do you, I know you do book signing events around the country. Do you meet the middle schoolers who are reading it? Do they say, there's a little bit of me there, I really identify with this guy?
Yeah. What's funny is actually I don't speak to a lot of middle schoolers. I think most middle schoolers have just slightly outgrown my books. Some kids in middle school still read them, but most of the kids I talk to are elementary school kids, and I think they really understand Greg. There's some sort of connection there that I think I understand.
That fits the pattern. That's my kids read and still read it in elementary school, so that makes sense. So one thing I didn't know, the first Diary of a Wimpy Kid started as a web series. How did you start releasing it that way?
That's right. I started releasing it on a website called FunBrain, which was a part of a company that I worked for, part of Pearson. And I was working for this website, and we needed to figure out how to get people to come back to the site during the summer because the traffic was very high during the school year. And so I said, well, I've been working on this thing for, you know, the past 7 or 8 years, and I think that, you know, we might be able to run it in daily installments and see if people will come back.
And the diary format works really well for that.
It does. It sort of just predated blogging, right when blogging was becoming popular on the web, you know, daily bits of content. I was starting to release these daily installments, and I found that kids, that actually adults from all over the world were reading what I was writing, and it was very exciting to get emails from Pakistan and Russia and China of adults, professionals that were reading about Greg Heffley and waiting to hear what happened next.
I think I saw you quoted somewhere saying you thought maybe this is too American originally to have other people around the world interested in it. That you have found has proven not to be the case. Does it make the translation?
Yeah, my first concern was actually that it not ever feel dated. So I tried to generalize everything in terms of technology. I tried to take out any references to pop culture or to really any place and time kind of references. And I think that because of that, it's made the books sort of general and generic in a way. And I think that in a sense, childhood is the same everywhere. It's universal. So I think that's helped by making it to take out those references. It's really helped to make it appealing in other cultures and countries.
So that's why he writes in a diary, not on a blog or a tablet or something like that.
Right. If I would have made this the blog of a wimpy kid, I think, you know, 2 years from now, nobody would know what
a blog
is. Right. Or Instagram of a wimpy kid. You know, you have to be careful about all that.
So in the newest installment, Hard Luck, Greg lost his best friend, Rowley, and is trying to make new friends. Just give us a taste of what life is like without his closest childhood friend.
Right. Well, Rowley has a girlfriend, and that's a shock to Greg's system. And what I was really trying to capture there was the feeling that you have as a teenager when your best friend gets a girlfriend or a boyfriend and you lose them to that person. So I think there's a lot of humor to be found there. And then Greg, of course, has invested so heavily in this one guy that that he finds out that he has to start over on the social ladder in middle school, which is not easy to do.
A lot of kids' books end with, maybe not explicitly, but a moral or a life lesson in it. Are you trying to do that, or do you want to leave that for other children's authors?
I really like to leave that to other children's authors because in my books, you know, kids can sniff out a moral. Mm. It's why they jump so quickly from a show like, you know, Barney to something more sophisticated, and they can feel the heavy hand of an adult. So I certainly don't want my books to seem amoral, but I want them to, you know, to feel like they're written for humor's sake and for entertainment's sake.
But given that people can identify with the main character in it, even if there's not a specific life lesson, I would imagine they can work through their own things and just by identifying with someone else.
Yeah, I read somebody online in a blog actually was writing about this very thing, and they were comparing Diary of a Wimpy Kid to Huckleberry Finn or Tom Sawyer, which is probably a bit too aspirational for my work. But what I really liked is that they said that that the writer, he let the readers make their own decisions. He trusted the readers to decide for themselves what they thought of the characters. And so I thought that was, you know, Mark Twain doing that was really smart. And that's what I'm trying to do, too, is that I would like for you to make up your own mind about Greg and the choices that he makes.
Now, Greg and some of the other characters in the book would be very happy playing video games all day, and that was part of my childhood and adulthood, too, I'll admit. And my kids are kind of the same, and my kids have played on the Pop Tropica website, a game website, and you're the creator of that. This is another thing I just learned today. How'd you come to that day job?
I was working for Pearson, and we were running a website called Fun Brain, and it had its advantages and disadvantages. And one day I was mowing the lawn, and it came up with this idea for a virtual world for kids. And I wanted to just kind of do it on my own, but I realized that we had this big audience and a great company behind us, so I'd be more successful in doing it in-house. So I still actually have my job there, and it's been very rewarding to have that to counterbalance the Wimpy Kid stuff.
Well, I wonder, are there lessons that apply to both of your worlds there? Are there ways that you engage a kid reader and a kid gamer that inform each other back and forth?
I think that what you need to do is you need to treat the kid as a sophisticated consumer. You know, I was worried about that when I first released my books because the tone was a little bit challenging. You know, Greg is unreliable and he's very flawed, which is a little bit unusual for kids series. So I think that, you know, with both properties, we try to write at a certain level of sophistication and then hope our readers, you know, meet us there.
So I always wonder about this with kids' books and with shows like The Simpsons. Do you plan to age Greg and the other characters over the years? Are we going to see the high school years of a Wimpy Kid?
I used to actually worry about that a lot because I said, boy, you know, Greg is going through a lot of middle school moments here, and eventually he's going to grow up. And then I had sort of a breakthrough thought was that Greg's DNA is really in cartoons. It's not in literature. And so I decided that Greg would stay the same age forever. In fact, I have a book called The Ugly Truth, which is the fifth book, and it's about puberty. And in that book, Greg's classmates are you know, they're going through the signs of puberty, like facial hair and pimples and all that. And Greg is frustrated that he's not growing up. And, you know, it's sort of my joke with myself is that he's not growing up because he can't, because he's a cartoon character.
So just in our last 30 seconds or so, in your head, does Greg grow up and win, kind of like you have? He's a successful children's author or with a computer company. Does he run Google someday?
I think Greg would grow up and not be a happy person. He'd be a victim of his own, you know, thought processes. So I think that he'll be a you know, a middle manager somewhere who's pretty petty, whereas his friend Rowley, who's a bit of a doofus right now, will grow up to be a healthy and well-rounded person.
All right. Well, good luck to Greg Rowley and to you, Jeff.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
That's Jeff Kinney, author of the Diary of Wimpy Kid series, newest installment out today. It's called Hard Luck.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, one guest says that we need a national town hall on football and the health risks associated with it.
And we'll discuss ways to improve science education around the country.
And then the Roller Derby World Championships are coming to Milwaukee, and we'll take a look at the sport that's seen a surge in popularity in the past decade.
That's tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll hear about a rise in online niche dating. We're thinking farmers only or gluten-free singles. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Online dating is now a fairly mainstream practice. One statistic estimates that 1 in 3 new marriages started with an online dating profile.
But there's something different happening in the online dating world. Now sites are popping up that cater to a certain demographic, such as gluten-free singles, farmers only, or even Atlasphere. That's a dating site, by the way, for Ayn Rand fans.
We want to hear from you on this. Have you ever participated in online dating? Have you ever signed up for really specific sites, or would you? What has your online dating experience been like? Did you meet a soulmate there? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send an email, talk@wpr.org.
This half hour, we're talking to Catalina Toma. She is an assistant professor in communication arts at UW-Madison and an expert in online dating. Catalina, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
I want to talk about this whole notion of online dating. Since the dawn of the internet, it's been out there. How quickly has it been growing, say, over the past 5 years, 10 years?
It's been growing tremendously quickly. Online dating started to gain traction in the early 2000s, and at the time, it was fairly stigmatized. It was viewed as some sort of a crutch for the desperate, for the people who perhaps couldn't find dates on their own in their offline lives. But increasingly, it's got it's become more prominent. It's got a big following, and in recent years, it really has exploded. A recent survey that's come out a couple of weeks ago shows that about 1 in 10 Americans have done online dating at some point, which is incredibly impressive.
And a crutch for the desperate, that must have sort of fallen by the wayside, because at some point this must be successful. It must work at some level.
It does. Some really impressive statistics and studies are showing us not just that online dating has become tremendously popular, but also that it's very successful. So recent studies show that about 1 in 3 marriages or 1 in 4 marriages happening in the United States in the past 6 or 7 years have originated from online dating. And one recent study has actually tracked these couples who have met online and assessed their satisfaction with their partners and also their likelihood to get divorced. And this study has found that the likelihood of getting divorced is slightly decreased if the meeting, the initial meeting between the partners takes place online rather than offline. And also that those who had met online report slightly more satisfaction with their partners, suggesting again that online dating has become a useful venue for meeting appropriate long-term relational partners.
And that's part of what we're talking about today, because we're talking about that sort of niche idea that you can meet somebody who's really, you know, really just focused in on your specific interests and so forth. But isn't that what general websites are designed to do anyway? If you sign up for a match.com, you answer all these questions, what I like, what I don't like, what I like to do, and so on. What differentiates these niche sites from the general ones?
There's two types of general or mainstream online dating sites out there. One is what we call self-matching sites. So those would be Match.com and OkCupid to a certain extent, where you fill in your own profile and then you're at liberty to browse through other people's profiles and decide who you want to contact. And then there's another type of site, the eHarmony model, and to a certain extent, OkCupid too, I suppose that would be more of a mixed site, where they have you fill out personality questionnaires and questionnaires about your values and beliefs, and then the site itself matches you with potential partners. So among those, popularity is really, really high. There's lots of users out there, and the potential bank of romantic partners that you have to go through could be high. So one may imagine that an online dater might feel overwhelmed with this really large selection of potential dates, depending also on the location where they are. If you're in an urban on an urban site, you would have access to hundreds, thousands, perhaps, of potential mates that you could choose from. And there's lots of information available about them that you could use in your decision-making processes. Now, this amount of information could conceivably be overwhelming and not helpful to people who have very niched or specific kind of requirements. And I suppose that's one of the reasons why more niched online dating sites have gained prominence. It narrows down the field of potential mate by that one characteristic that's really important to you.
And so if you have that important characteristic, whether it's you're a farmer or whether you're a Christian or whatever it might be, it allows you to get it right out there in front so people know that this is sort of number one in my wish list.
Exactly. It's a non-negotiable or a potential relational deal breaker, and it allows you to be really upfront about it and use it as the main criterion for selecting who you go out on a date with, significantly reducing the amount of time and effort that you put into online dating. This could be costly in terms of time and energy, but also costly in terms of money if you go out on numerous dates trying to find somebody who's a good match for you.
So if you're into saving money, niche websites might be where you want to go. How quickly have these been proliferating, and what kind of range of interests are you seeing, or is it like people, sort of limitless?
It's certainly limitless. The internet does allow for a limitless array of such sites, for sure. And we've seen quite a growth in this area and some wide proliferation, with some obvious, perhaps, dating sites that pertain to people's religious orientation or sexual orientation or things that we might predict and expect that would be important for people. We've had J-Date for a while. We've had Christian Singles for a while. And then we're seeing more and more niched such sites, including gluten-free dating and fans of Ayn Rand that you have mentioned. So certainly it's a limitless possibility out there.
Well, we've got some listeners who'd like to weigh in. And if you'd like to join in, too, our number is 800-642-1234. Let's go to Aaron. Aaron joins us from Green Bay. Hi.
Hello.
Hi. You've got a story to tell us about Match.com.
Yes, I do. I decided to get on Match.com several years ago, trying to figure out if there really are more fish in the sea. I had gotten off of a bad relationship, and I found my now husband on Match.com on the very first day. I signed up and made a profile, and we ended up conversing through email a lot, and then phone, and eventually met up, and the rest is history. And I'm just calling to encourage other people who are interested in finding a partner to not be afraid to get on online dating. It might be a little scary at first, but you soon realize that the people on there are just like you, just trying to find somebody, and I highly recommend it.
Aaron, and before we let you go, Match.com is one of the self-matching sites we talked about where you get to write your own profile. I mean, everything you wrote there was true?
Oh, yes, absolutely. 100% true. Yes, and then they also let you select different traits that you're interested in finding as a match.
All right. Well, thanks, and good luck, and congratulations. Let's go to Sean. Sean joins us now from Presque Isle. Hi, Sean.
Yes, hello, and good afternoon, everybody.
Go on, you're on the air.
Yeah, I just called to say that I've tried numerous sites, including the big names that you mentioned, some of the niche sites, everything from green singles to sites that were more dedicated to alternative lifestyles. And I guess the difficulty that I've run into now is I'm currently 41. I've already been divorced once. My children are already teenagers. So my direct and upfront intent has just been brutal honesty in my profiles. And the difficulty is I've found that people in my age bracket, if marriage is not your outright goal, if having more children is not your outright goal for my age sect, it just has not borne any fruit.
Well, Sean, thanks so much for the call. And Catalina, we had two stories there, one very successful on Match.com, and then we heard from Sean, who's tried any number of sites. They haven't worked for him. And as I was listening to those two stories, it sort of sounded like regular dating used to be without the technology. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
That's a great insight, actually. And as our first caller said, it's still just people at the end of the day who are trying to find somebody. So in numerous ways, online dating is very similar to face-to-face traditional offline dating, although the technology does change a few things. One of the things it does change is how easy it is to lie about yourself. It's literally the click of a button, posting a different photograph or an older photograph of yourself. It is technologically easy to lie if you want to, but many people choose not to, even though they can, because they know that relational success in the long run is contingent on an honest self-presentation. And in fact, research shows, consistent with Aaron's story that we listened to, that the more online daters are interested in establishing serious, long-term, committed relationships, the more honest they are in their profiles.
And it was interesting in Aaron's call, you know, we talked about that sort of the reputation of online dating, and she was urging people who might be reluctant. So even now in 2013, it sounds as though in some cases there is still that reluctance to go online and put yourself out there.
There is a reluctance, and it's an understandable one. For once, you make yourself and very private information about yourself available to a large group of strangers. And lots of people could feel vulnerable about that and perhaps uncomfortable with that. So maybe it's not so much a stigma for desperate people anymore, but there's still potentially a level of discomfort. A fear of being judged or encountering strangers who might not be nice people. So for those reasons, some people still legitimately may postpone online dating or may think twice about it. But we have also seen that it is a helpful resource in the dating arena with lots of successful marriages and relationships so far.
We're talking to Catalina Toma. She is an assistant professor in communication arts at UW-Madison and an expert in online dating.
And we want to hear from you on this topic. Have you ever done online dating, or have you considered it, but there was something that kept you from trying it out? Tell us what that is. And have you or would you participate in one of these niche sites we're talking about for a particular religion, say, or an occupation like farming or a political philosophy? Call in at 800-642-1234. That is 800-642-1234. You can also email your story to talk@WPR.org.
Give us a call or drop us a note, and we'll continue this discussion after a check of the headlines. This is Central Time. And I'm Gene Purcell. We're continuing our discussion about online dating with Catalina Toma now. She's an assistant professor in communication arts at UW-Madison and an expert in online dating.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org with your experiences or maybe what keeps you from participating in online dating. 800-642-1234.
And a lot of listeners would like to join in, so let's go straight to the phones. And we begin with Kathy, who joins us from Milwaukee. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I just had a question for the experts here. I had a really good experience with online dating, although I met my significant other actually at work. If there's a disparity between men's experience and women's, because I have a lot of guy friends who are just very negative towards it, and then I have a lot of lady friends who met their significant others there, and I don't know if there's a difference in the number of participants that affects that happiness or what it is.
Well, let's find out. That's a great question. Thanks for the call, Kathy. And Catalina Toma, what about that? Is there a difference in the way that men and women use the sites or the perceptions they might have of the sites?
It is a really great question and interesting point. I'm not familiar with research that looks at the satisfaction level of men and women, but I am familiar with research that shows that men and women may have different practices. And one practice that could affect satisfaction is that, much like in traditional dating, men are still expected to take the lead in initiating relationships in online dating. So it is very much so that men contact women much more so than the other way around. So if you're a woman, you're likely to receive a lot of requests and emails. And if you're a man, you're likely to have to initiate more. And one can easily imagine how if you initiate lots of requests and send emails and fail to get responses, as is often the case, it could be disappointing and a dissatisfying experience. Kathy, can you tell us a little bit more about why your friends find online dating problematic?
No, I'm afraid we've lost Kathy. But, you know, one of the questions I'd like to ask, because it strikes me that this is 2013, and you say that one of the reasons men might not be so enthusiastic about this is because they're expected to make the first move. Has online dating changed any of those expectations? I mean, do you see a change over time that it's okay for a woman to make the first contact?
Well, I certainly think that it's okay for a woman to make the first contact. We don't know if online dating has had any effect on society at large just yet. So far, we're seeing the same patterns with online dating that we're seeing with offline dating, in that men do tend to initiate a great deal more than women.
So it sounds like people are people, kind of despite the technology.
Exactly.
Vince joins us now from Delavan. Hi, Vince.
Hi. I had a question about the overall satisfaction of kind of the population online and offline. I know you had said that online users have a little more satisfaction in their relationship, but I was wondering if kind of that phenomenon of if you're presented with more options, you feel like the one that you chose might not have been the perfect option. And I wonder if with the growing circle of people that you can interact with, it's not just at your school or at your workplace or within your friend's friends, now with this towns up to 100 miles away and thousands of people, if in general, because we know we can interact with more, are we as satisfied with the person we choose?
Vince, that's a great question. Thanks for that. Catalina Toma, what about that? That feeling that there are so many more choices out there that even though I got a great one, there might be a better one, you know, another click away.
That is a very insightful point, Vince. Actually, there's literature that's documenting what we like to call the kid in the candy store phenomenon, the idea that you have so many potential mates and so many people that you choose to choose from that you may feel reluctant to commit to any one of them and feel compelled to continue playing the field, if you will, because there might be somebody better or more desirable out there. So this phenomenon has been documented. There's no research studies to date that directly address how the number of choices you have affects satisfaction, but we would predict that, indeed, the more choices you have, the less satisfied you might be with the one that you do settle on, because the grass could always be greener, right, on the other side.
And with the online world, you can see a lot more of that grass. I mean, there are just so many things to look at.
Exactly.
We have an email from Laura in Milwaukee, and she tells us that she met her soon-to-be husband this past May online, and so she's good with that and never would have met if they hadn't met online. However, she says, I'm still highly skeptical, even though I had a good experience, because of safety issues for women. Is that something that women need to be concerned about? Is that a reality that when you're online, it is a different world and that you do need to be extra safe? Or is it just like meeting somebody in a bar, meeting somebody on the street?
I think people always need to be careful about who they're meeting with and sharing private moment with, perhaps, regardless of whether the meeting originates online and offline. But it is true that the online world does open up the prospect to a broader range of people that you could potentially meet. So safety is a concern. The majority of dating sites do a pretty good job at advising their users on how to handle initial relationships. we always have to remember that the internet is not just a tool for us to meet a variety of other of potential partners and strangers and potentially problematic people, but it's also a useful tool for finding out information about people. So Googling people and trying to get information about them and to verify the accuracy of what it is that they're telling us is a really important thing that I think women and men alike should be doing.
But, you know, when you say things like that, a lot of people might come back and say, you know, you're taking all the romance and all the fun out of everything. If I'm going to Google somebody, I'm going to look up their record online. You know, where's the fun in that?
Well, there, you know, there could be fun in conversation, in private disclosures, in getting to know the person on a more intimate and less institutionalized level, I suppose. And I'm not saying you should be trying to find out everything about a person's life, nor that that's possible on the internet, but certain pieces of information that may be relevant to your personal safety could be a good idea to gauge.
We've got a call from Kirsten, and Kirsten joins us from Oshkosh. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm actually speaking for as a gay person from Oshkosh here, and I am calling it to show my support for online dating, although I've never done it, and I'm currently partnered after 9 years, I've often wondered if I, you know, weren't to be with my partner, what would my options be? And I always felt that I had to go to a bar in order to meet somebody that's of my minority. And so I'm very supportive of this because I think it gives people another opportunity.
Thank you so much for sharing this, Kirsten. And I completely agree with you. And research supports this idea that online dating is a great option for people whose social circles are perhaps not sufficiently large to contain a great majority of single and available people for a variety of reasons. We call this the access hypothesis. So online dating does provide increased access to people who could need it and might benefit from it. So thank you so much for sharing your opinion.
As you look at the world of online dating, of niche dating right now, where do you see it going? Do you see it getting more and more compartmentalized, or do you see us reaching some sort of point where you can only get so narrow and then you start running out of options and you're cutting things a little too finely?
Oh, that's a great question. The crystal ball question.
I'm
going to try to make some useful predictions. Well, the success of online dating is contingent on connecting people with potential partners. So you do have to have a number of partners to choose from. Being overly niched might be a detriment for that. If you just have, you know, 100 people to choose from in all age ranges and all sorts of interests, online dating might not work very well for you. So I think it's a balancing act between connecting people with reasonable potential partners, but not overwhelming them.
So as long as it works, it might happen. And if it doesn't work, it'll probably fade away.
Yes.
Catalina, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've been talking with Catalina Toma. She is an assistant professor in communication arts in UW-Madison and an expert in online dating.
Up next, it's the news. Then we're talking about the possible end of the death penalty in the United States, but maybe not for the reasons you might expect. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Gene Purcell. That's all coming up next on Central Time. And you're listening to it here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.